Well, guys, if you have your Bible open with me, we are in John chapter 18. We've been studying through the book of John for the last 6 months in a series that we've been calling Getting to Know Jesus. And what better way to get to know Jesus than to look at his word, to look at what he's told us about himself, to look what he did in his life. And so we're doing that here today in John chapter 18. And over the last few weeks, we've moved through the triumphal entry. That was back in chapter 12 as Jesus comes into Jerusalem. That's what we're celebrating here today at Palm Sunday. We've also moved from there into, well, we know that Passion Week, what took place, that on Monday, Jesus went into the temple. He cleansed the temple. There was money changers that had moved into the temple. There was people buying and selling animals in the temple. And Jesus literally ran them out of the temple and said, you've made this a den of thieves, but God's house is to be a house of prayer. And so he cleansed the temple. On Tuesday and Wednesday, he's back in the temple teaching the people. And on Thursday, and that's where we've been for the last several weeks, he's in the upper room with his disciples. And in that upper room, we've seen different examples. We've seen him give the example of love and servanthood as he showed the disciples, didn't teach them, but he showed them what a servant was and that he washed their feet. And then we see the teaching that we still celebrate today in Holy Communion as he took the cup and he took the bread and he taught his disciples to do this in remembrance of me. And then last week, we saw those final words there in the upper room and in the form of a prayer. It was a three-part prayer as he prayed first for himself. He prayed, God, would you glorify me so that I can in return give you glory? That as I go to the cross, as I endure this difficulty, may I give you glory, may I give you praise with my life. And then he prayed also for his disciples. He prayed, may they stand in truth and may they continue in the truth. He knew that they're going to have a difficult life. He knew that what they had signed up for and the commitment that they had made wasn't going to be easy. And so he prayed that they would stand firm in the truth of God's word. And then he prayed for you and he prayed for me. What an amazing thought that is, that Jesus, the Son of God, prayed for you and he prayed for me. Because he prayed for all believers that were to come. And what he prayed for you and what he prayed for me was that we would stand in unity and love. And as we stand in unity and love, that the world would see it and that they would come to give glory to God. And so the question is for us as a church, are we unified? Are we standing in unity? Are we standing in love? When other people see that, do they give praise to God because of what they see in our lives? That was his prayer for his disciples. And then in chapter 18, and that's where we are today. And if you need a Bible, you can just raise your hand. John has some Bibles in the back. He can pass one of those to you. You can follow along with us. We're going to be between John chapter 18 and Luke chapter 22 or 23 because we see the same story taking place in both of these books. And so John chapter 18, and it says this, and when they had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and he crossed the Kidron Valley, and on the other side there was an olive grove and he and his disciples went to often. And so he leaves the upper room, he leaves Jerusalem, he goes across the Kidron Valley, up on the mountain across that overlooked Jerusalem to the Garden of Gethsemane, to an olive garden. Not olive garden like you're thinking of, but like a garden with olives in it. And so it's there that they go, and John doesn't give us this account, but we know they begin to pray that Jesus is in a deep place of prayer there in that garden. It wasn't an easy time for him. He is literally wrestling in prayer because he knows what lies ahead of him. He literally is praying. He's praying with such emotion and such intensity that he's sweating drops of blood. And his prayer is, Father, if there be any other way, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. He knew what was just before him. He knew what was coming, the suffering and the pain and the death that was just hours away. And he said, God, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. But then he surrendered to the Father's will. He surrendered. And he said, "Your will be done." He knew that God had chosen this form, this way, that it would be through his life that God would reconcile man and God. Because that's what Jesus' life was about. It was about laying it down so that he can in turn reconcile God to man. And so he surrendered to that. You know, to fully understand what took place on the cross, we need to understand a little bit of the Old Testament kind of sacrificial system. I remember one time a guy came to church and he said, "Daniel, what's all this like singing and talk about blood? It's just kind of weird." And I don't know, that week we probably sang a song like about being washed in the blood, or maybe we sang a song about his blood is enough, or we sang a song about how beautiful is the cross. And he's just like, "That just doesn't sound right. There's something wrong with that." But you need to understand in the Old Testament what the sacrificial system was. See, man messed up, right? With Adam and Eve, they messed up. And if it hadn't have been Adam and Eve, I can assure you it would have been Daniel and Sarah, or it would have been you guys. We would have messed up. God gave us free will, and with that free will, we blew it. And sin entered this world. And what sin did was it broke the relationship between God and man. And so it had to be reconciled. And in the Old Testament, you see when someone did something wrong or when someone needed to confess sin, that they would come and they would take a lamb, a spotless lamb, and they would put it on the altar and they would sacrifice it to God, and it would cover their sins. Now, this system was incomplete because, notice, I said it covered their sin. It didn't forgive their sin. It covered their sin. But what Jesus does here on the cross, and we're going to look at that next week. We're going to look at the cross and the resurrection. But what Jesus did on the cross didn't just cover our sin. It gave a way for our sin to be forgiven. Forgiven, washed clean. And so Jesus knew that's what lay before him. And he's wrestling there in the garden. He knows what's coming. And then looking on in verse 2, it says, "Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place." So he knew where this Garden of Gethsemane was because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. And so Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some of the officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. And they were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons. And Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they responded, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he said, "I am he." And the Judas, the traitor, was standing there as well. And when Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and they fell to the ground. Now, can you imagine this? They've come to arrest Jesus. There's some Roman officials there, I'm sure, but there's also temple guards and religious leaders and all of these people. And they come there, maybe dozens, maybe 100 men, to arrest one man. And when Jesus identifies himself, and we know from other gospels that Judas also kissed him on the cheek to identify him as well, but when he identified himself and says, "I am he," they fell to the ground. What an amazing thought, like the power in those words, "I am," literally pushed them to the ground. We don't know if it was an earthquake that shook the ground or like a sonic boom or what happened, but they literally fell to the ground. And now at this point, I think I would get up and go home. But they get up and they continue in their mission. And again, he asks them, "Who is it that you want?" And they probably said, "Jesus of Nazareth." You know, they're cringing, they're ready for it. And he said, "I told you, I am he." And then he said, If you're looking for me, then let these men go. This happened so that the words that he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one that you gave me. And then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it, and he struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. And Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink this cup that the Father has given me? And so they've come into the garden to arrest Jesus. They've identified him. Then Peter decides he's going to fight his way out of this, right? And cuts a guy's ear off. Why an ear? I don't know. John doesn't give us the story, but in the other Gospels, we know that Jesus reaches out, touches the man's ear, and it's healed. Again, this would be a good time to go home. You know, it's like, all right, maybe we're in over our head here. But they continue on. Throughout the rest of this night, well, verse 12 tells us this detachment of soldiers and their commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus and they bound him. And throughout the rest of this night and into the early morning, Jesus is going to go through six trials, if you will, or at least questionings. Three of these are with the Jewish high officials and religious leaders from Annas to Caiaphas to the Sanhedrin. But then he's also going to stand before the Roman leaders as well, and in six different trials. And in these trials, they're not looking for justice. In these trials, they're not looking for the truth. In these trials, they're looking to do one thing, and that was get rid of Jesus. Because Jesus had disrupted their religious system. At this point, their religious system, the Jewish religious system, was all about tradition and ritual. And here comes this rabbi, this guy, Jesus, comes along, and it's not about ritual and it's not about tradition. He's talking about relationship. He could care less what you're doing tradition and ritual-wise. Do you have a relationship with God? Are you one with God? That was his focus. And so they wanted him out of the way. And so we're going to look at a couple of these trials, and we're going to see how they respond. And I want to tell you, they make some mistakes. How many of you have ever learned from your own mistakes? You learned something from your mistakes. Listen, I will never put my hand in a meat grinder again. I promise you. I learned my lesson. I won't do it. I will never jump off of my parents' house and try to hit the pool. I won't do it again. There's some things that we learn from mistakes. But did you know this? You can learn from other people's mistakes as well. And most of you, if you're honest, you would rather learn that way. Poor guy, but you would rather learn from his mistake than have to make the mistake yourself. And so this morning, I want to look at some mistakes that we see these guys make as Jesus endures, as he goes through these trials, so that we won't make these mistakes as well. The first one is Pilate. And in verse 28 of chapter 18, it says, then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas, so he's already gone through those questionings with the Jewish officials, and they lead him to the palace of the Roman governor, and this is Pilate. But now it was early in the morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanliness, the Jews did not enter the palace. They wouldn't go into the house or the home of a Gentile because they wanted to eat the Passover dinner that evening. We see their rituals. We see their traditions. And so Pilate came out to them and he asked them, what charges are you bringing against this man? And then they say, well, if he wasn't a criminal, we wouldn't have brought him here. And Pilate said, well, take him and judge him by your own law. But they don't want to do that. And the reason they don't want to do that is because the Romans had taken corporal punishment from them. That they could judge people by their own law. They could punish people by their own law. But the Jews couldn't carry out corporal punishment. They couldn't execute anyone. So that's why they're bringing him to the Roman officials. And we can look at Pilate and we can see some mistakes that he's about to make. Now, Pilate and the Jews, they got off to kind of a rocky start. When Pilate was appointed to be the governor of Judea, as he came into the city with his Roman entourage, they marched right up to the Temple Mount. And here they are with their crescents and their emblems and all of these things. And the Jewish leaders just got all up in arms because this is idolatry. And they would bring it up here onto the Temple Mount. And so they're literally trying to run all of these Roman soldiers and run Pilate off of the Temple Mount. And Pilate just says, you know, I could just have all of you killed. And so they back up. And so from the very beginning, their relationship was one of compromise. Their relationship, Pilate and the Jewish leaders, was one of kind of give and take. And we're going to see that even in this trial, is it's a bit of compromise and give and take. And so they brought him before Pilate, and he asks, what are the charges that you bring against him? And we best see those in Luke chapter 23, verse 2. And it says, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this man subverting our nation. He is opposing payment of taxes to Caesar, and he claims to be a king. These are the two charges that they're bringing against Jesus, that he opposes us paying our taxes, and he claims to be a king. Well, you know, the first one is a flat-out lie, because earlier in that same week, they asked Jesus a question. They were trying to trap him. They asked him, if you will, a trick question, because they said, should we pay taxes, yes or no? Should we pay taxes to Caesar? And they knew that if Jesus said, yes, you should pay taxes, then he would lose all of his Jewish following. But they also knew if he said, no, you shouldn't pay taxes, then all of a sudden, he's going to have the Romans against him. And so Jesus wisely answers, or he says, show me a coin. And they show him a coin, and he says, whose image is on it? And they said, Caesar. And he said, then give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God's. Did he tell them not to pay their taxes? No, he did the very opposite. He said, give it to him, but make sure you're giving to God what is God's. And so that was a false accusation. The second one, he claimed to be the Messiah, or he claimed to be a king. Well, Pilate wants to know a little bit more about that. He wants to ask him about that. And so we see him in verse 5. He says, in verse 3, Pilate asked Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. You know, he continues to question him. And if you flip with me back over to John chapter 18, verse 38, he goes on to, Jesus explains to him a little bit before that in verse 36, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight and they would prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place. He's telling them, listen, this is not my kingdom. This world is not my home. This is not my kingdom here on this earth. And so Pilate realizes what he's saying, and he says he's really no threat to us. He's not trying to overthrow the Roman governor. He's not trying to take a place here on earth. And so he goes on in verse 38. He says, what is truth? Pilate asked. With this, he went out again to the Jews and he said, I find no basis for the charge against him. He says he's innocent. And there's really only one thing to do with an innocent person, and that's to take the chains off and let him go. But that's not what Pilate does. We're told in John chapter 19, verse 12, that Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar, and whoever makes himself out to be a king speaks against Caesar. And so he realizes, I know this guy's innocent, and I know there's no fault in him, if I let him go, then I've got some trouble. I'm gonna have trouble with these guys. And remember, his life is a life of compromise. And so he compromises here again. And here's what we see. Here's the battle going on with Pilate. It's his conscience versus convenience. Because his conscience says he's innocent. His conscience says, I need to let him go. But convenience, that's a different story. Because if he does that, then he's going to have problems. And so he compromises. How often do we find ourselves in that same position where our conscience says one thing versus convenience? Where our part of us is screaming out, do the right thing, and another part is crying out, it's going to cost you. Do the right thing, but how much is it going to cost me? In Matthew's account of this same story, chapter 27, Pilate asks, what shall I do with Jesus? And that's the question right there. What shall I do with Jesus? That's a question that we all have to ask ourselves. That's a question that we all have to ask at some point in our life. What are we going to do with Jesus? What decision are we going to make? So Pilate figures it out. He doesn't want to make the wrong decision. He doesn't feel like he can do the right thing. And so what does he do? He does nothing. If I can't do the right thing and I don't want to do the wrong thing, I'll just do nothing. But listen, guys, no decision is a decision. No decision is a decision. If I tell you, hey, I'm going to go to San Jose tomorrow at 1 o'clock. I'm going to leave here from the church tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Do you want to go with me? And you say, well, let me think about it. I'm not sure if I want to go with you. I've ridden with you once before and not sure I want to do that again. And so you have to think about it. And then tomorrow comes and it's 1:30 in the afternoon and you're sitting at your house still thinking about it. Guess what? You've made a decision. You've made a decision not to go because I told you we're leaving at 1 o'clock. Your no decision was a decision. And so we have to make a decision. Pilate's no decision was a decision. You know, every week here at Horizon, I give you an opportunity to make a decision about what we just talked about. What am I going to do with Jesus? And many of you have responded to that question and you've made a decision. I'm gonna follow Jesus with my life. I'm gonna surrender my heart, my mind, my soul, all to the Lord. And I'm gonna pursue him with my life. And some of you made that decision here in this church. Others of you made that decision years ago in another place, another time. And some of you wrestle with that question almost every week. What am I gonna do with Jesus? And it comes time to make a decision. And you think, I'm going to wait. I'm going to put it off. And I want you to know that your no decision is a decision. And so, looking on at Pilate, you know what's interesting about Pilate is he asked the right question. He asked him, are you the Messiah? Are you the king? He asked him the right question. And you know what? He even got the right answers. Because Jesus told him, it is as you say it is. I am who you say I am. And so he asked the right questions. He got the right answers, but that's not enough. We have to have the right response. And sometimes that's where we fall short. Guys, we can learn from Pilate's mistake right here. Not live a life of compromise. Not let our convenience outweigh our conscience. And we need to make a decision. The second person we see, because what Pilate does is, since he didn't want to make a decision, he decides to send him over to Herod. And he says, I don't want this blood to be on my hands. I don't want to make this decision. So I'm going to send him over to Herod, who happened to be in town that week because it was a big celebration week. It was Passover week. And so he sends him over to Herod's palace. And Herod is actually really excited to see Jesus. We're told that Herod actually had an interest, it was more of a curiosity of the things of God. So much so that back when John the Baptist was actually preaching and teaching, Herod went to see John the Baptist teach. He went out into the wilderness. He was so intrigued. He wanted to hear what he had to say. But then John the Baptist turned to Herod and called him out because he had actually stolen his brother's wife, and he didn't like that, and so he put him in prison. And then eventually, because of Herod's wife, he beheaded John the Baptist. And so here's Jesus, someone he'd heard a lot about, and he has a lot of interest in or a lot of curiosity about. And we're told in Luke's account, in that chapter 23, verse 8, it says, when Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracles. All right? So Herod's excited. Here he is. He's standing in front of me. Maybe I can get him to do something amazing. I can see him do something for me. But then we're told that Jesus wouldn't answer his questions, that Jesus stood silently before him, that Jesus didn't perform any miracles. You know, at this point, if Jesus would have simply turned water into wine, Herod would have let him go. If he would have done a miracle, or if he would have told him something about Herod that no one else knew, then Herod would have let him go. But that wasn't Jesus' intentions, was to be let go. His intentions were to follow through with this plan of laying his life down, of being that perfect sacrifice. And so Herod is disappointed. He wanted Jesus for one reason and one reason only, and that was to meet his needs. Do something for me. Show me something. Tell me something. Meet my needs. And you know, people will do the same thing today. Is they'll come and they'll say, if God will do this or God will do that, then I'll believe. I heard a story one time about a guy that was running late for a meeting. And it was one of those places where it was impossible to find parking, like downtown Hako, right? There's just no parking. And this guy was worried he's going to be late for his meeting. And if I miss this meeting, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose these opportunities. And so he's all stressed out. And he wasn't a person of faith, but he thought, I'm going to try it anyway. And so he prayed right there in his car. And he said, God, if you will give me a parking place right in front of that building, then I'll believe in you and I'll serve you and I'll go to church and I'll give to the church and I'll do all those things that I've never done. If you'll give me a parking space right in front of the building. He comes around the corner and can you believe it? A car pulls out and a parking place opens up right in front of the building. And he looked up at the heavens and he said, never mind, God, I found one. See, God can show us. He can reveal himself. But so often, that's not what we're really looking for. That doesn't answer our need. We saw that with the Israelites. Man, if anybody ever saw God's hand of faithfulness and perform and show them things over and over and over again, it was the Israelites. God had led them out of Egypt miraculously. He had miraculously opened up the Red Sea for them to pass through to escape the Pharaoh's pursuit. He had provided manna for them to eat in the wilderness, quail for them to eat in the wilderness. He had provided water for them. He had led them by fire by night and by a cloud by day. Man, they had seen God's hand so faithfully again and again and again. But they still continued in their loss of hope and their loss of faith. And often signs and wonders only lead to wanting more signs and wonders, and there's no faith at all. And curiosity about the things of God doesn't equal belief in the things of God. And Herod's mistake is that he wouldn't move from a place of seeking or a place of curiosity to a place of belief. We need to make sure we don't make that same mistake. And then throughout this whole story, from the questioning by the Sanhedrin to the questioning by Pilate and the questioning by Herod, there's one person that a lot of us can relate to, and that's Peter. Peter was a faithful follower of God. Matter of fact, in the upper room, when Jesus goes to wash his feet, he says, "No, Lord, you can't wash my feet." And God said, "Well, if I don't wash your feet, then you're not a part of me." And he said, "Then wash my whole body. I want all of it." This is a guy that was all in. And then when Jesus told him in the upper room, "You know that you're gonna deny me," he said, it'll never happen. "I would give my life for you. I would lay it down gladly for you." But then we see through these questionings and we see through these trials, or through these trials that Jesus is being questioned in. In verse 17 of chapter 18, it says, "You are not one of his disciples, are you?" the girl at the door asked Peter, and he replied, "I am not." And then again in verse 25, Simon Peter stood warming himself, and he was asked, "You are not one of his disciples, are you?" And he denied it again, "I am not." And then one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter cut off. Like, this is the guy that's like, "Hey, I remember you, man. You're the crazy sword-wielding guy in the garden. Aren't you one of him?" And Peter, again, denied it, and he said, "I am not." Three times he denied Christ. We can learn from that mistake. You may not be able to relate to Pilate. You may be doing a great job of being led by your conscience and following God. You may not be able to relate to Herod in that it's not about curiosity for you. You've put your faith in Christ and you believe wholeheartedly. But you may be at a place like Peter where you're a faithful follower of God, but yet when the moment really comes, you have a hard time really standing for your faith, really stepping up and being bold in your witness. I had a guy tell me one time, he was so excited. These two guys came up and he said, "You know, it's amazing. We've worked together for 5 years and never knew each other was a Christian until we saw each other here at church today." And I said, "That's horrible. Isn't that terrible? That you worked for someone with 5 years and you didn't know they were Christian?" That I didn't say this to them, but this is what I was thinking. How have you guys been acting at work? That you wouldn't know each other were believers. We need to make sure that we're standing firm, that we are not embarrassed, that we don't shy back, that we are standing boldly, no matter the consequences, that we'll stand boldly. I'm going to ask the worship team to come back up. As we close this morning, they finally make a decision. Herod puts it back to Pilate. Pilate washes his hands of the whole thing. But what Pilate does in verses 38 and 40, in verse 39 actually, he says, "But it's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at a time at the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" And they shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Barabbas. Barabbas was a murderer. Barabbas was a person who had started a rebellion. Barabbas was a guilty man. He was a person that had done wrong. He was a person that was guilty. He was a person that deserved punishment and deserved judgment. But instead, Jesus takes his place. You know, there's probably no one here this morning that would say, "I'm a Barabbas." But in a sense, we all are, because we've all done wrong. We've done things we shouldn't have done. We've acted in ways we shouldn't have acted. We've done things that, in God's eyes, makes us guilty. We've done wrong and we deserve punishment for that. But here's the beauty. Here's the beauty of the cross. Here's the beauty of Jesus' mission, is that he took your place. Your guilt, your wrongdoing, he took it upon himself. And by his blood that was shed, our sins are forever forgiven. Let's stand together as we close our service this morning. I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that. Maybe you're realizing you're in one of those places where you say, I've been curious, but my curiosity has never really brought me to a place of belief. Maybe this morning you want to firm that up. Or maybe this morning you're saying, I've been guilty of letting my convenience get in the way of my conscience. And this morning I want to follow my conscience, what God telling me is right. Or maybe you say, I've been a Peter. I haven't been standing boldly with Christ. And I want you to pray that I would do that. And this altar is open. If you want to come here and pray, you can. There'll be a couple of people up here that would love to pray with you if the Lord puts on your heart. And so let's respond to the Lord. Let's enter into a time of prayer.
Grace, what have you done? Murdered for me on that cross. Accused in absence of wrong.